It's said of writer Bruce Brooks that what he writes transcends his genre. His books are most often found in the hands of 9- and 10-year-olds, of junior high school kids, but don't be misled. The themes, the plots, the characterizations are all complex, which is why Bruce Brooks wins awards for his stories. I'm Susan McGinnis for Conversations. Join us today when we talk with a man who's not a children's author, Bruce Brooks. Bruce, welcome and thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I want to deal with that question right up front.
Well, I want you to tell me what I am since you've just told me what I'm not.
No. No, I want you to do that. Your classifications are juvenile fiction, young adults, mm-hmm. and children's books. Mm-hmm. And yet, I understand that you don't set out to write a children's book in any way. So tell me, what do you set out to write, and what do you feel you write?
Well, I don't set out to write a children's book in any way. I should say that everything I answer that seems to relate to the field of children's books and genres and all that stuff applies really only to me. There are plenty of people who set out expressly to write children's books, and authors who have very clear ideas of what their readers' vocabulary levels are, or what's appropriate or not appropriate for a kid of, you know, these grade levels to read. Mm. That kind of stuff would drive me crazy. I don't pretend to know that much about somebody's reading level, and I really don't want to think about it. The reason that I've gotten put into, happily I might add, into the genre of children's literature is that my books are about families in which teenagers have some kind of a central role in deciding what happens to their lives and what happens to the lives of their families. I've discovered after 5 books now focused this way, I've discovered why it is that I seem to be drawn to such stories and to such characters, and I'll elaborate on that a little later if you'd like. Sure. But mainly, my publisher, HarperCollins, feels that it's enough that the books are about kids, that they don't have to be for kids, and that the writing them expressly for kids, in my case and in the case of a lot of people, means that you treat your readers with a certain condescension or a certain specialness or a certain cuteness or something, a reflection of any of the ways in which we often mistakenly treat children in our culture. It's much better to write children's books without trying sometimes. Just as you might carry on a conversation with someone standing behind one of these screens in a very demanding, challenging, articulate, and intelligent way, if you thought that person were an adult, and if it turned out the person stepped out from behind the screen and were a 12-year-old, you might think, oh my goodness, I would speak completely differently if I'd known that. Mm-hmm. With the children's book, you write with that same kind of, you know, demanding, challenging, articulate quality, and count on the readers, whoever they are and whatever age they are, to manifest enough intelligence to get what you're saying.
Is that why children's literature gets a kind of a bum rap? Because people do write for some sort of pigeonholed 9-year-old?
There's some of that. That's not the main reason I think children's literature gets such a bum rap. I think that children's literature gets a bum rap for 2 main reasons. The first reason is that it's often defined by its trash, by its genre literature. I mean, children's literature is a field with a lot of different genres within it, just as adult literature has its westerns and its mysteries and its romances. And, you know, when we think of defining Western literature, we think, oh, well, you know, Virginia Woolf, Henry James, the most elite, sort of, not elitist, but elite people who do the most challenging, interesting things. When you hear people define children's literature these days, and there is an article in a major paper at least once every 6 months about it, every paper I see, someone will say, oh, I was at a bookstore the other day, and I was in the children's section, and I saw the Berenstain Bear books, and I saw the Babysitter's Club, and I saw, you know, Christopher Pike horror books, and what, you know, what trash kids are reading, and what trash people are publishing for them. It's the same thing as someone walking into Baker & Baker and saying, oh my gosh, there's Louis L'Amour, and there's Tom Clancy, and there's Stephen King. Adults in America are trashy. But, you know, there's good literature for kids just as there's good literature for adults. And I think if you focus on that, you can have more respect for the field and for the kids themselves.
I've also heard a prejudice within the field, at least, that there seems to be some sort of a negative myth that writers will say, well, I'll just write a children's book and kind of get it out of my system, and then I'll be a real writer. Mm-hmm. Or they'll say of other writers that anybody who was a child, has a child, thinks about kids, mm-hmm. thinks that they can write a children's book. Mm-hmm. So, and that one just says this is too mm-hmm. simple to believe.
Right? Yeah, there's a myth about becoming a writer that sort of presumes a corollary with our own growth as adult, into adulthood, mm-hmm. and that the myth is that we start out, you know, with kids' stuff, and we move on into the real stuff, which happens when we're over 30. I think that just as there are a lot of people who will say to you, "Oh, you're a writer! Gosh, I always wanted to write. If I had the time, I'd really write." There are a lot of people who say, "Oh, you know, I'd love to write books because I love kids, you know, and so on." It's the same kind of illusion about the hard work of writing and the subtlety of reading and all that sort of thing. It's a common mistake. I think that pediatricians, school teachers, children's librarians, anybody in our culture who deals primarily with children gets the same thing from their colleagues in the profession. I mean, I have friends who are pediatricians and mm-hmm. their colleagues who are cancer researchers or who are internists for adults treat them with, you know, as if they're doing some kind of public service that's okay, and, you know, it's one day you may do some serious medicine. Meanwhile, if those doctors' kids get sick, they go to the pediatrician with tremendous demands. Mm-hmm. I think writers often, not out of a willful condescension, but more out of a mistaken assumption about kids, treat children's book writers with that kind of an attitude that, oh, it's something slightly less. The thing that I've discovered in 8 years now of writing for kids and of spending a lot of time going around and talking to them in junior high schools and high schools and elementary schools around the country is something that I knew when I started, but that's been reaffirmed for me. And that's that young adults are not lesser adults, they're just younger than we are. Their intelligence is the equal of ours. We place so much emphasis when we differentiate ourselves from children by saying, oh, we've got all this experience, but it doesn't always lead to an increase in percipience. Kids understand things far more keenly and readily than we always think they do, or than we often think they do, and books are some of the things they understand. My main characters tend to be very smart kids who are forced into taking control of some aspect of their lives, as I've mentioned. And I think one of the reasons I write about them is I'm railing at my collegial adults to say, look, these are kids, but look what they know. A lot of other kids know this much as well. They make very interesting characters, I'll tell you.
They do. Mm-hmm. This is Bruce Brooks with us today on Conversations, and I'm your host, Susan McGinnis. In case you're interested, or in case you just want to smile at the memory of titles you've read, Bruce Brooks' fiction includes The Moves Make the Man. That's a basketball story. Sounds like it. It is. It's published, as all his books are, by Harper Row in 1984. Midnight Hour Encore is published when?
86.
No Kidding was published in 89. Everywhere in 1990. And there's a new one on the way called What Hearts. It's currently in galley form, anticipated to be out when?
October of this month.
All right. This is Conversations. Everywhere is the most recently published book of fiction. It's a story of a grandfather who has a heart attack and a young boy, 9, 10 years old, who is forced by his grandfather's frailty to begin looking at qualities like suffering, loneliness, the extent of our character's own abilities in controlling things outside himself. It's been called a classic Southern exploration of such things as loneliness and faith, and through which Bruce Brooks has been compared with some of the best Southern writers in our time.
Would you keep going?
I'm sorry. But would you take over and read a bit from Everywhere?
Oh, I'd rather hear some more of those wonderful comparisons.
Let's reintroduce this man and this book.
Okay, Everywhere. I'll read a little bit from chapter 3 here.
Good.
My grandfather kept his ties in a tall cherry wood chiffer robe. It had a room pretty much to itself around the corner from his bedroom on the second floor of the house. He called the chiffarobe Jeeves after a character in some books he liked. He said he couldn't get dressed without Jeeves, and it was true. Jeeves held his 4 or 5 suits in a tall compartment for hangers, his shirts and socks in a smoothly worn drawer, and his jewelry in built-in bird's-eye maple boxes lined with spruce green felt. But the chiffarobe's best feature was a collapsible nickel tie rack that folded out from the inside of its left-hand door to offer my grandfather his fabulous array of silk bow ties. There was a photograph in my father's wallet of my grandfather and me when I was 3 months old. I'm sitting naked on the large porcelain sink top in the second-story bathroom, facing into the mirror above it, grinning toothlessly. Behind me is my grandfather, with his head on a level with mine, also smiling into the mirror. And around my neck is a perfectly knotted paisley bow tie. My grandfather holds each jaunty end between thumb and forefinger as if he has just finished tightening it from behind. Between my feet is a Leica camera, which my grandfather somehow managed to trigger so that our reflection is caught. It is proof. I always loved his bow ties. He would wear no other kind of tie, and neither would I. On dressy occasions, while my father cursed over his Windsor knots in the bathroom, and my mother and grandmother fussed with scarves and jewelry and powder, my grandfather and I stood cool before Jeeves. We drew on shirts, crisp and fragrant with starch, trousers, socks, and suspenders, and laid our jackets on the single chair with which Jeeves shared the room. Then my grandfather would lightly rake the hanging curtain of bow ties with his hand, sending their pointed and squared ends hopping in a dance of colors and patterns. "Well," he would say, "which one for me?" I would study his shirt, he liked bold stripes, and his suit fabric, he was fond of checks, houndstooths, pin cords, and herringbones, and take several ties to hold against his waist where shirt meant suit. Finally, I would choose one and hold it up to him, and he would thank me and nod it without a moment's hesitation. Then he'd invite me to choose one for myself, which he tied while I stood on the chair's ottoman and watched in the small silver-framed mirror above the tie rack. Never once did my grandfather second-guess my choice of a tie for him. Never did he raise an eyebrow or laugh when I chose, say, a violet and burnt orange paisley to go with a shell pink shirt and a licorice-striped seersucker suit, or a red and black box pattern for a forest green Tattersall shirt and a chestnut jacket. Many times in the beginning, my grandmother would gasp when she saw him and say, "Ellington, you must change that tie." But he would only smile, kiss her cheek, and winking at me, give the tie an extra tweak. "It's the very tie for this splendid evening, my dear. Shall we go?"
Nice.
Thanks.
Everywhere by Bruce Brooks, a book that came out in 1990. It seems in this book, as in others, you show us the characters through detail with what our protagonist watches and details about the grandfather. Mm-hmm. Is this the way to bring us in from your perspective, or one of many?
Well, it depends. I mean, the book's a first-person narration, and anytime you're using a lot of detail in a first-person narration, it's meant to reflect fascination with the tale or a capability for a detail in that person who's narrating the story, and certainly that's a characteristic of this guy. One of the things is that he's narrating the book as an adult looking back on this time, and in Moves Make the Man and Midnight Hour Encores, the other two first-person narrations that I've written, the narratives are contemporaneous with the events that are going on. The kids are writing them as kids. And I think that I was aware when I was writing this how visual the book was and how sensory the details were. I mean, there's a lot of visual cues and mm-hmm. smells and sounds and so on. And I meant that to indicate to the reader the willful retention of the sensations that this character had for all the years intervening between the time he's remembering back and writing the story and the time the events took place. And it also indicates not just the strength of memory, but a certain keenness of attention and wit and intelligence. People who notice things, and that reveals something about their consciousness. And I think that when you have a lot of detail in a first-person narration, you're doing two things. You're giving the reader a lot of richness, and that's certainly important, but you're also revealing that quality in the narrator's mind.
Your books, those that I've read anyway, deal with issues that aren't easily resolved, like grief, like discovering your own limitations, like coping in Moves Make the Man, which seems to me to be a story of coping and the inability to cope. I guess I'll just ask this in this way. Do you set out to explore issues that don't have easy resolution?
Well, I think that as a writer, I always set out to write a book that, however relentlessly it is planned and however strategically I know in advance what I want to say, the book nevertheless will provide a lot of surprises for me. Mm-hmm. I think that the processes of reading and writing are very similar, and I think that both of them are dominated by the imagination. And I think that the imagination always flows towards that which it doesn't know. I think that although I have a very clear idea of my stories, I always choose to write a particular story because there's a lot in it that I know I'm not going to get to the bottom of unless I really work. I never get to the bottom of most of the things in my books, and I think that one of the reasons my readers reread them, which is nice, is that they realize the first time through that they haven't solved them. The books don't click shut like change purses. They stay open, and there's implication and resonance and so on. I hope that's the case. It is for me as a writer. I write these books, and I'm very aware of what I haven't figured out as well as what I have. But when I look back, and when many of us look back at the books in our lives that we've read that continue to stay with us, often we'll find those qualities in those books, and I think that's what I'm imitating. Consciously, yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm in it not just to make something nice for somebody to read. I'm in it for growth myself. And I grow through trying difficult things, and I grow through reaching for something that isn't within reach. Mm-hmm. You know, that sounds really literary and precious. But I mean, I if there's a difficult problem that characters are having, I don't know how to solve it. I'm going to write a book and see if I can discover a way. And if I don't, at least the book would be an artifact of the attempt, and that's often interesting.
And are you aware of those successes and failures? I wrote the best that I could in X book. I still don't get how this works.
I wouldn't call it a success or a failure. I'd say I'm aware of the richness of the involvement, and I'm aware of, I hope, the richness of the experience my readers led into by reading the book. Mm. And if I felt that it were a failure, I wouldn't send it into the publisher. I mean, I think that the attempt to resolve some of these things leads to something that is invigorating and stimulating and gets the reader going into places a reader otherwise might not have gone with mind and heart. And that's a success. I don't feel like leading a reader to a specific answer is necessarily a success. But I'm aware of what I hope is interesting as a read in my books. And mm-hmm. And I would count it more of a success if a book does resist that kind of solution and does hang with me. So,
this is a question I've puzzled with myself over whether to ask or not, but you alluded to it earlier, so I'd like to kind of forge ahead. Your own childhood was not the easiest. You've referred to it as not the typical family situation, and kind of where you invented your childhood as you went along. Is that also part of the reason that you write for whom you write, about what you write?
Well, I don't know. I don't tend to think of, and this is sort of a defensive strategy myself, I think. I don't tend to think of my childhood as being, having this characteristic or that characteristic. I think we all kind of take whatever we get as a childhood. I do think that I'm interested in recognizing how much I understood and how much I knew and how much I was capable of at the ages that my characters are also living. And I look back on those years as being tremendously important. We all do, really. I mean, we all think back to early relationships, early friendships, early love affairs, early whatever, and think, gosh, you know, that was so potent and mysterious and rich back then. I've just never outgrown that fascination, I think. And I do always come upon surprises in my own life. In my own life as a father, I have an 8.5-year-old son.
And another baby
on the way, to be born in a couple months. I keep coming upon situations that indicate to me how much I have not gained wisdom by growing 34 years past that age myself. What I've gained is a certain recognition of how right my instincts were back then. There are times, of course, where I've gained enough wisdom to learn not to lose my temper the way my son loses his or something like that. But often, I'll see my son involved in something and I'll start to talk with him about solving a particular problem he has. And I'll think, you know what? I'm going to say the same thing I would have said when I was eight. And what's more, he's feeling it himself, so I'm just going to encourage him to take care of that himself. And that kind of recognition, and it happens a lot, that when I was 12, I really knew what was happening with this problem in my life. For example, my parents were divorced, and my mother remarried and then separated from her husband, and she was an alcoholic and was also addicted to prescription drugs. And it was a nutty, kind of a frequently moving sort of life. And I think back and I think, you know, I really did understand then what was happening to her with the drugs, or I really did notice the difference between her several personalities and what was influencing which. And I really did know how far I could go with my stepfather in expressing concern about my mother's situation. There's all this stuff that wasn't sophisticated, because sophistication is defined by, you know, richness of experience, but that was nevertheless quite alert and intelligent. And I think, as I said before, I'm dedicated to proving to readers now that kids are that bright and can function that way. So I think I am fascinated that way still with my own childhood. It sounds awful to say. I wish I could get on with my life.
No, I don't know. I mean, you're known for examining core issues, and perhaps it's just so that core issues begin early and last long. Mm. I mean, maybe it's as simple as that.
Core issues. Yeah. Think about that. I thought I was writing about basketball. No.
This is Bruce Brooks. I'm Susan McGinnis, and you're attuned to Conversations. Let me give you a scattering of the signs of Bruce Brooks' following and appreciation, both from adults and from youngsters. Moves Makes the Man, at my last count, earned 6 awards. The Newbery Honor Book, it was the Newbery Honor Book in 1985. That's one of the top awards you can get for a young person's book. The Boston Globe Horn Book Award for fiction that same year. Best Books for Young Adults, Beck's Books of 1984. Notable Children's Books for 1984, and on and on. Midnight Hour Encore took 2 awards in 1986, and No Kidding took 3 in 1989. Awards just seem to follow. Bruce Brooks is also a writer of nonfiction, which we'll ask about here. The latest is called Predator. It's published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux. And On the Wing, The Life of Birds from Feathers to Flight, published by Charles Scribner. On the Wing came out in 1989 and was the companion to a PBS program, Nature.
Yeah, the relationship was one of association rather than direct inspiration. Some of the people at WNET 13 in New York who produced the Nature show decided they would like to hook up with a publisher and publish a series of books which would be promoted on the Nature program, or after the Nature program, if promoted is a proper word to use. They're not allowed to advertise or anything, of course, but books that would be a resource for people who are interested in natural things by the show, and the you know, they could then be led to these books and for further explorations in the same kind of detail that Nature shows follow. I was approached about submitting a proposal for the book, and I did so, and the publisher and the people at WNET decided to accept the proposal and basically asked me to write whatever book I wanted to write about birds according to the proposal. And I'll confess, I haven't ever seen any of the Nature TV shows. I really didn't want to gum up my own inspiration for writing the book. And I did my own research and I came up with my own book. Fortunately, the people at WNET and at Scribner's decided that its messages were compatible with the TV shows. And so they've used it in that promotional way. The other books, the two books you mentioned, Predator and Nature by Design, are also in the same affiliation. But again, they're books I wrote out of my own interest in. Farrar, Straus published them, you know, independently, but they're associated with nature by dint of nature saying, well, here's a resource for further study if you're interested in these things.
Now, is this, how do you view these books? Are these assignment books for you, or do you, did you somehow also begin life or come into life with a strong interest in natural things, or birds in particular?
Well, yeah, the latter. I don't, this is terribly pompous of me to say, but I don't, I hope I wouldn't write an assignment book. I mean, I hope my days of assignments are over. I really want to write books about a lot of different things. And I was unhappy when I was first pigeonholed as a boys, young adult sports writing novelist. So I immediately wrote a book that's narrated by a girl who's a cellist. And I thought, well, take that. And then, after, you know, I was asked to speak at a conference as a realist. And I thought, oh, wow. Well, my next book was set 75 years in the future. And also was in the third person, which had broken with that the earlier strain of first-person narratives. And I think I always am looking around, not in a willful, iconoclastic way, but more in an urge to be versatile. I'm looking around for different things to do. And I've always been, you know, a real nature freak. I've always been the kind of kid who takes three-hour walks in the woods and comes home with three birds' nests and four broken eggshells and nine feathers and needs to go to the library and spend a couple hours looking all of them up and figuring out, you know, who built them and why and how. That kind of detailed investigative spirit is something that, you know, very naturally I wanted to use in writing. And so that's what led to On the Wing and then the other books too. So it's a reflection of something about me that I want to pursue.
This is Conversations on KUAC. I'm Susan McGinnis, and my guest today is Bruce Brooks. Will you read to us from On the Wing? We just happen to have a copy.
Sure. Yeah, well, what do you know? You guys are clever. Would you prefer that I warbled it in the voice of a Swainson's warbler, or shall I read in English?
Oh, no, do both.
No, babe, I think perhaps I'll just read in English.
No, this as is long from, as you've brought it up. No,
this is from Chapter 2, called Sky Life. It's a chapter about flight. It is so easy to think of flight as one simple act. A bird on a branch lifts sudden wings, leans into the wind, and lets go. It's aloft. It looks so natural up there. Well, it is natural up there. A bird in flight is destiny in motion, a creature using every iota of equipment and instinct put together for it by centuries of evolution. But flight is far from simple, and far from being, quote, one movement, end quote. For a bird, flight is more like the sum of all things, a miraculous capability that takes everything a bird's got. Each body system has to do its part. Each feature of physiognomy has to cooperate. If a bird had teeth instead of a beak, it couldn't fly. If its blood didn't kick in with more red corpuscles per ounce than any other creature in the world, it would never get off the ground. Almost any quirk we might question in avian physiology, why such a zippy metabolism, why feathers, has its raison d'etre in some esoteric requirement of flight. On the ground, looking up, we cannot see the red corpuscles and hinged ribs making their complex contributions. We see instead a sleek, strange form doing something that goes against our own experience of the laws of nature and doing it with unconscious grace. Consider this. Gravity is the most consistent element of human experience. We know it better than we know our comparatively periodic heartbeat or breath, because there is not an instant when we do not feel its pull. Gravity is always the same wherever we go, and for every person. We honor our Mikhail Baryshnikovs and our Michael Jordans by saying they defy gravity when they leap a little higher than others and look light about it. But what is their defiance compared to the merest flutter of a wren? So we tend to look at flight as a single act, revoking this single law. But of course, flight is not an escape from gravity. The bird in the air feels the pull as much as we do on the ground. In fact, as we shall see, the bird uses gravity to maintain its flight speed, much as we do when we coast on a bicycle down a hilly street. Gravity to birds is just one component to be combined with everything else for the purpose of keeping aloft.
This is Bruce Brooks reading from his book, On the Wing.
It was a book, the inspiration for which was to write something that contained a lot of good science and but used the good science to answer basic curiosities about, you know, how strange birds were, why birds did the things they do. And it's meant to be a book that is for reading, you know, more than just for sort of fact checking and stuff like that. And therefore, the narrative is more conversational. Now, what were you going to say?
Well, I was asking the first part of that answer. Mm-hmm. Does a book like this take a lot of research for you? And did you spend a lot of time figuring out how to take facts and put them before people in a way that would invite their reading?
Well, I found it much easier simply to make everything up. No. Yeah, it took a lot of research. I read a lot of books about birds.
You are quick.
I talked to a lot of bird scientists, and you know, had some wonderful interviews with people. I went to Harvard, to a laboratory at Harvard, where someone had invented this very Rube Goldberg looking device to take X-ray movies of birds that were put into a wind tunnel and flew in a wind tunnel, and the wind was blown back against them at their flight speed, so that they were flying like crazy directly in front of the lens of this movie camera that made an X-ray film of their skeletal articulations while they were flying. And I got to watch these birds fly and see how their little ribs and spine worked and all that business while they were actually flying. And then the best was to peek around the corner and actually see this poor little starling in there laboring, not going anywhere, and you know, in the middle of this air tunnel. I went to the Smithsonian and institution and talked to this wonderful woman who is a scientist there, and is a very senior scientist, I might add, but sort of wanders around in a lab coat full of feathers. Her name is Roxy Layburn, and she's the world's foremost expert on feathers. She has some tremendous richness of knowledge that she's gained from a lifetime of looking at feathers and studying feathers, and also some almost mystical sense of intuition about feathers. The point that there are lots of people who pass through Washington from all over the world who have gotten into the habit of bringing her feathers from Pakistan or New Zealand or whatever and handing them to her, and she'll go, this is an emu fowl, probably from West Africa, offhand I'd say Senegal, and then hands it back. She's an incredible person who just contains all of this knowledge, and she does a lot of work with the FBI on murder cases where there are feathers from down coats involved, and actually they've solved some cases because she has identified the particular kind of down that a particular kind of coat contained, and it was found and the suspect's car, blah, 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 and all that business. And, you know, people like that I got to meet in doing the book, and it was really fun. Nevertheless, for all the facts that I picked up, what was particularly enjoyable about the book was that I decided in advance what I wanted to do. And most of the facts I learned really fit in with that initial idea. I wanted to go through and look at the queer features of birds and the things that seem most unlike us in the way they function, the way we function, and show why birds had that equipment, what they did with that equipment, and how that was similar to our own processes of life. And, you know, it was easy to learn stuff regarding that. And I read probably 300 or 400 bird books in the process of doing it. There are a lot of bird books out there. This is the best one, though.
Right. On the Way by mm-hmm. Bruce Brooks. Did you, when you were a kid, try to figure out how things worked?
Yeah, a lot. What do you mean?
I mean, did this man who reads 300 to 400 bird books and follows around one of the world's leading feather scientists at the Smithsonian and interviews ornithologists begin as a boy child who took that bird nest apart to figure out how it was built?
Yeah, I was very analytical. Yeah, about people and things at school and you know, as well as birds' nests and stuff. I think a lot of writers have that quality. I mean, I think writers like to take things apart and put them back together. You know, there are several things that writers generally have in common. Most writers are spies. Most writers have good ears and they mimic voice as well. Most writers also, I think, are analytical, and often it's a kind of an intuitive analysis. In my case, I think it was something I was born with, but also something I developed as a mechanism for adapting to a childhood in which the surroundings were often changing. When I was six, I moved from Washington, D.C. to North Carolina, and it was really different moving from Washington, D.C. to North Carolina. And then I moved around a lot in North Carolina, from small towns to tobacco cities to beach towns and so on. I got very good at being placed in a situation, shooting my antennae out there and figuring out what was going on, how to fit in, how much I could imitate this, how much I could stand off from that, and what kind of words I would have to use and with these people, you know, and what kind of impressions I wanted to create with those people. And that kind of analytical thinking on my feet is the same thing really that leads to the book, the Bird Book, or any of the other things, I think.
Sure.
That, you know.
Is that also partly an explanation for why you are able to capture a teenage African-American boy or a young, gifted, black female musician, white kids, black kids, mm-hmm. kids from various environments?
I think so. I think I should mention that the white girl musician and the black teenage boy and the sort of severely pretending kid who, and no kidding, who was a child of an alcoholic. All of these people come to me first as people, and I get to know them as people, individuals. And I get to know them very well before I try to produce their voices as narratives. And that's important. That's an important step. The step of getting to know people, though, is really what you're asking about, mm-hmm. whether it's an invented person or not. I think that, again, most writers have an exaggerated capability of a trait that all human beings have, which is the quality of empathy. I think that if you're the kind of person who gets on a bus in your hometown and is going down the same street you go down to every day, to go home from work, and you know you see a homeless person on the street, and you follow, as long as the bus is going by, you follow your eyes to the homeless person, you see what kind of socks he's wearing, how many holes they have in it, and you wonder what it's like, whether his feet are this cold or that cold, if he's there by choice. He looked as if his beard were really well combed, and he had a little wax on the ends of his mustache. How does he just, you know, what makes him wax his mustache and yet not have shoes? And what does he eat? When was his last meal? And you begin to really spend the next 10 minutes on the bus wondering very clearly with your senses and with your intellect and with your emotions what that person's life is like. That's the sign of somebody who very well might turn out to be a fiction writer, because that's the quality that puts you into characters' lives. And when the character has a different race, when the character has a different gender, when the character lives in a different era, when the character lives in a different place, all of those features are less forbidding than they might seem to the imagination, because I'm a 42-year-old white male who's 5'6" and likes ice hockey. Now, if I were going to write a narrative about a 5'6" well, 5'6" actually and a half white male who likes ice hockey, who's 42, I would have to really think and invent a voice. I wouldn't be able just to spew it out. The imagination would have to be engaged, and for me to do the same thing for a 13-year-old black boy or a 16.5-year-old white girl involves as much arrogance as it would to tell any narrative, but also involves that same kind of empathy and imagination, without the massive leap that we sometimes think it takes to jump cultural differences. It's a touchy issue, because it can seem sort of colonialist and imperialistic of me to appropriate the voice of a person of another race or another gender. And I don't think it is, or I hope it's not. I really don't think it is, because I'm never seeking to represent the African American experience or the female experience or something like that. I wouldn't presume to represent the white male 42-year-old experience. I'm representing the life of one person, and that person has a lot of features, one of which is his or her race, his or her gender, and so on. That empathy is what really leads me into that. How's that for an answer?
It's great. This is sort of a related question. Did you have to learn a lot of basketball to get Jerome Foxworthy in The Moves Make the Man? Or did that, did it come from watching as a kid or playing as a kid?
I'm a basketball magician. No, I did have to learn. I didn't go out and memorize a lot of moves or you know, watch a lot of kids play or anything like that. It all came entirely out of my own wishful experience. I played basketball most of my life, and much more slowly now than I did when I was a kid. But I wasn't as good as Jerome is. And in that way, I was, you know, making a little vicarious gesture of wishful thinking. It wasn't really, I didn't really have to research that. I didn't really have to research the music for Midnight Hour Encores either, even though I can't read music and I don't play the cello. I had to research less of the bird stuff than you might think, too. The reason is that all of these books arose out of personal enthusiasms. I love basketball, and I've watched basketball all my life, and I've played it, and I love birds. And I've always thought about birds, and, you know, I've always listened to lots of music. So the research, in a way, is the product of the kind of keen attention we pay to the things we like. And that, combined with imagination about what somebody, what a particular person would be like if his or her life were engaged to a fuller degree than my own, is just a natural extension of that interest.
Is the process of writing fun for you?
Oh, yeah, it's great. I love it.
And some writers say it's simple, open a vein and bleed on the page. And others say, I wouldn't do anything else. This is every day I go to have fun at my computer.
Well, it's fun. I mean, I do it because I like it. It's the only thing I really wanted to do since I was 10. Well, not really. I would have been the shortstop for the Yankees if somebody had given me a break. But
and a good one, too.
Yeah, right. I can really go to my right. The one thing, though, is that the fact that I enjoy it so much does not mitigate its difficulty. It's hard, you know. But I think that we're often attracted to things that are difficult, but that we can nevertheless do. Everybody likes a challenge, really. I mean, that's why, you know, if you give a person the choice to just laze around the house and sleep for a year, a person will do it for a couple of months at the most, and then just start building something or start doing something or start involving himself in some activity that goes beyond the limits of his present experience. And writing is like that. Writing is a constant challenge. You never get to the end of a book you write. You never arrive as a writer at a plateau where you're comfortable, because as soon as you finish one book, you've got to go back and be a beginner all over again with the next book. And I think most of us choose our next project because it's going to demand things of us that we don't yet know we can do. I think that some people obviously get in a groove, and they tend to be the more professional writers, and I don't say that with a sneer, but they tend to be the people who say, okay, I'm good at this kind of book, and I made $600,000 last year off this kind of book, so I'm going to write this kind of book again and make $800,000. And that's fine, you know. I'd love to discover that groove for a little while, but I think that a lot of us write this kind of book and think, okay, I did that, but, you know, now I want to do something that's a little different and a little harder and that uses skills I don't really know if I possess yet. And we learn how to write that book in the process of doing it. That's challenging, and it's difficult, and it's often frustrating, and it often feels almost as if you are, you know, agonizing. But you're not, really. I mean, you're in control, and you're doing something that is really a blessing. Nobody's sitting there yelling at you and telling you to do stuff and making you stay late. You're responsible for yourself. And I never lose sight of the fact, especially since I worked for so many years in jobs where I had to do things other than write fiction or nonfiction of my own choosing, I never lose sight of the fact that, you know, I'm very lucky. And when I'm having a tough day, if I were ever tempted to feel sorry for myself and go into that romantic, suffering writer bit, all I have to do is think, hey, around the corner is a guy who's a printer, gets home at 8:30 every night, sees his kids for 5 minutes before they go to bed, and he's got to do that. I'm sitting here writing. I'm going to meet my son at the school bus in an hour and play football with him for an hour and a half and then cook dinner. And, you know, hey, well, who am I to complain about toughness? And that makes me appreciate more the ease of it as well as the difficulty.
Right. Bruce Brooks, our guest on Conversations. Bruce was born in 1950, as he mentioned. He's 42, born in Washington, D.C.
No, Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Oh. an error in the research.
A major error.
How could this happen? Well, let's check the next couple of things.
Okay.
He spent much of his child in North Carolina, graduated from the University of North Carolina, and then from the University of Iowa Writers Workshop.
You didn't mention my the decoration I received by participating in the French Resistance in World War II. And then the Nobel Prize isn't on there either, but we'll let that slip.
I was coming to the Nobel Prize,
good. Yes, of course. Jumped the gun.
Well, now here, I want to check this fact with you. I understand you started writing comic books. Mm-hmm. And one of the problems with comic books was that the speech balloons got so big that they forced your drawings right off the paper.
Yeah, that's true. I started by doing comic books about a superhero I invented called Sonic Man.
He was very loud, very fast.
Well, he had the capability to be very loud. Sonic Man was a guy who wore a purple and red suit. I can't imagine why I chose purple and red, but I did. I had a crayon that was purple on one side and red on the other, and I could just flip it over. And, you know, he wore tights and all that stuff. And I couldn't draw hands very well, so Sonic Man had these sort of bronze cuffs on the end of his arms. And he would walk through the streets and see some emergency, and he would raise one of his cuffs, and I remember the sound was GZ, 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 gzug, gzug, gzug. These little yellow squiggles would come out, and they were concentrated sound waves, and they would, you know, he could make them do almost anything. They could shatter bad guys' guns or bring down spaceships that were terrorizing some part of his city or something like that. And Sonic Man. And I went through, you know, for about a year, I did a Sonic Man comic book every month. And I noticed, as you mentioned, that by the end of my year's run with Sonic Man, I was increasingly writing things people said to each other and narrative description of what was about to happen. And the words were beginning to fill up more and more and more of the panels, so that often I had just a little head down in the bottom with a big speech balloon full of several sentences. And I thought, gee, you know, I think maybe it's time to drop the drawing and just write, see if I can write some Sonic Man stories just in prose. And it was also a relief because there were no photocopy machines on every street corner back then, and I made about 6 copies of every comic book, and I had to draw them all and color them all in with colored pencils and all that business. So when I went to words, it was easy. I have several issues of Sonic Man.
Good.
And they're really bad. They're really terrible stories. And yet, you know, they got me started, so.
Maybe you should keep those things around. This got me started, framed and on the wall.
Mm-hmm. I'm hoping to donate it someday to, you know, a major library collection and get a tremendous tax write-off for it.
With the Nobel Prize.
Well, that, of course.
Of course, yeah. Bruce Brooks. What do you think of the state of kids reading today? People are saying in all sorts of slick magazines repeatedly, kids are not reading, they're becoming square-eyed from watching television, going to video stores, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Are kids reading?
Well, kids are reading a lot. They're probably not reading as much as we'd like them to, and they're not reading, you know, as much great stuff as we'd like them to. And I certainly, although I'm going to say that kids are reading, let me preface it by saying I do not want to say anything that seems to be construed as an argument against unplugging all the television sets in America. Sorry, except for this show. I do think that, you know, kids watch too much tube, and I think that, except for shows like this, when you watch television, you can get kind of immunized to a lot of things that you can get sort of put into habits of receptivity rather than action. And reading is an active thing. You know, you pick up a book and you open it up and you see R-E-D. You have to make that read in your mind as a creative thing. Not to sound too precious about it, but reading is a process of building, of creating for the reader. And I think that with all of the sophisticated editing and attack on all the senses that TV provides, that kids are much more sitting back and just letting it wash over them. However, and that's quite without the comparison of material in the TV shows and the books. Kids can certainly read books that have as much horrific material in them as your average primetime TV show has. But just the act of reading and the act of TV watching, I think, are constitutionally different. And reading probably is more stimulating and healthy for the imagination. I think, though, that the imagination is something kids are born with, and the imagination is not satisfied always by TV, and the imagination is always going to look for some way to fulfill itself. I think that kids are going to always want to do something creative. And reading is what a lot of kids do turn to. And reading programs in schools are changing now, and kids are being encouraged to read more books and fewer sort of readers that treat reading as a pure technical skill, as a pure decoding skill.
Dick and Jane when we were kids.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Or, you know, or little three-paragraph essays on the annual rainfall of Sumatra, followed by study questions to assess what reading level you are at. And, you know, that reading is more than simply the comprehension and decoding of letters. I think that, you know, something called the whole language movement is really having a big impact in schools. And whole language basically treats all of a kid's interaction with language and reading and in writing and in speaking as part of an entirety reflective of, you know, of everything a kid is and does. And kids read books, they do a lot of writing, they talk about the stories they're reading and so on. And they're reading things that make them readers rather than simply make them decoders. Eventually, I think everybody has the capability of becoming a very strong reader. Whether or not the situation in a school or in a home is conducive to having a kid just cross paths with that one book that teaches the kid, wow, this is interesting, this is fun. Whether it's a Stephen King novel, or I should say a Peter Straub novel, he's a much better writer, or whether it's a fantastically demanding novel by some marvelous 42-year-old white male, 5'6" young adult writer, the kid is gonna read it and go, ooh, I want more of this. Now that can happen to anybody. Whether you're a sixth grader with a third grade reading level, or a fourth grader with a 12th grade reading level, it can happen to you. You'll find a book that teaches you that reading is fun. And there's a huge, huge population in America of incredibly dedicated children's librarians who are the primary experts in children's literature and the primary people who are trying to institute good reading programs in kids and in schools. They're working very closely with a lot of teachers. The teachers, however, are often dominated by curricula that insist that they simply get kids up to a level where they will test out, if they're in the sixth grade, they will test out as being capable of reading a sixth grade comprehension essay. The librarians and the English teachers who are willing to use literature in the classroom are discovering that more and more kids become good readers because they find that reading competes well with TV. And we can only hope that continues to happen. The people who read to their kids a lot and who value books and value reading in their children do tend to presume that's common. But it may be common, but it certainly isn't universal. And there are all too many households that have no books in them, where questions of avoiding a beating or you know, staying away from guns or drugs or all kinds of other dangerous things are far more prevalent. Those kids have to have their paths crossed with books in the school or in the library or at some point. I think what we can do as a culture is try to increase the opportunities kids will have to cross paths with a good book. And make sure that when they do, there's someone who will discuss the book with them or something like that. I think that reading is going to be okay. There will always be readers. The stuff that the book is dead and all that is nonsense, I think. I can see the theoretical background for it. But because of the difference in creativity of response between book and the visual or oral media, I think that there will always be a place for silent, private, creative work. The individual needs that. And, you know, mm-hmm. Reading is silent, private. You're in charge of it. Nobody tells you not to turn the page back and reread the previous paragraph. And I think that's something that kids like. A long answer, I'm sorry.
No, it's all right. I think it needed it. We have just 3 minutes left. And I want you to use that time, if you will, to tell us a little bit about this next book, Whole Heart.
Wet Hearts.
Wet Heart, sorry. It's okay. And maybe take us out reading a short piece from
okay.
it. Is that fair?
Yeah, sure, fair. Wet Hearts is a collection of four stories, long stories, about 45, 50 pages each, about the same character at different points in his childhood. They sort of add up to a novel, I think, in a way. I mean, they don't really, they're not a novel, but when you've finished all four stories, you've taken the character through some significant experiences in his life. And the gaps between the stories are left as gaps. They're sometimes referred to by things that happened in later stories. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, it's a structure that seems appropriate to these stories and to this kid and his life. The interesting thing about the book, one of the interesting things about the book privately to me, is that it's the first time I've really admitted that I'm writing about things that happened to my to me in my life. Before, parts of me have worked into my books, but I've always avoided admitting that. I hate the idea of confessional literature or therapeutic literature or literature that has any, that needs to have any basis in reality. And so I've often invented a young black narrator or a female musician narrator and said, ha-ha, see, this isn't me. But this time I've actually felt comfortable writing about a kid who was very much living the way I lived and doing a lot of the things I did. So that's that.
Give us an all-too-brief sampling.
I'll give you an all-too-brief sampling. This is the beginning of the second story, which is called Not Blue. Standing in the doorway, looking in past the principal, waiting to introduce him, Asa could see that his new fourth grade class was just starting Rome. On one side of the room, the boys were waving cardboard swords and wooden spears with tinfoil points. On the other side, the girls were wrapping themselves in white bedsheets. It had to be Rome. In his previous school, they had already whipped through this part of history. But glancing around the room, he sensed a big difference here, a difference that gave him a little boost of excitement. The spears and togas, the number of fat books in the bookcases, the radiant messiness of wild drawings on the art bulletin board, the absence of the cardboard flashcards showing how the alphabet was formed in cursive, these were all good signs. Asa could tell about a classroom spirit by now, almost by sniffing the air. Mrs. Brock, a short, plump young woman who had waved at the principal and finished fastening a spear point before coming over, looked like she was going to be fine. In his previous fourth grade, the teacher had not been very good. She would not have dared to split the class up this way into groups. And swords? Never. They had spent 2 days sitting in their five rows of six desks, talking only about the splendor of Roman banquets, as if the entire civilization had been based on eating a lot while lying down. The other teacher had also been pretty bad at bringing Asa into the class, though he had arrived only 4 days after the beginning of the school year. She sagged when he came to the door, shaking her head at the rows of neatly occupied desks. He knew she did not dislike him. She was just not up to the task of stirring a new kid into her stew. That's how it usually was. Two teachers in the second grade, two in the third, and now he was on his second and the fourth. He felt sorry for them all. He wanted to reassure them the first time he appeared at the doors of their classrooms in the middle of a lesson. He wanted to tell them it was okay if they just let him be. He would find a way in all by himself, just far enough in to satisfy everyone, and then before long he would be gone. Mrs. Brock glanced a quick smile at him, then gave her attention to the principal. It was a good smile that said, "Let's get this official guy out of the way, and then we'll have plenty of time to get together." Asa exhaled silently with relief. As soon as the principal withdrew, Mrs. Brock pulled Asa into the room and guided him over to the huddle of boys. A waft of soft perfume rose warmly from the arm that lay across his shoulders. "All right," she said, handing him a sword. "You'll be, oh, let's see, Antonius. Thursday, you and these three senators will present a report to the tribunal on the prospects for war with Carthage. You be the one to talk about the elephants, okay? Okay, guys?" "I was going to do the elephants," said a large boy with a thick shirt, eyeing Asa. "Then you do the weapons of Carthage now, Mark," said Mrs. Brock. "You're the wicked type, so that ought to keep you happy. Do pikes and hooks and scimitars and whatever ever else the Carthaginians planned on sticking into your flabby pink Roman ribcage. Have you," she said, turning to Asa, with what he could only recognize as brilliant intuition, "ever seen an elephant?" "African or Indian?" he said. He blushed, ashamed of showing off, for he had seen both in the National Zoo. "Lord help us, a smarty pants," she said, turning away to go rewrap the girls in togas.
Nice.
Thanks.
Bruce Brooks, reading from his latest book, What Heart, to be published by HarperCollins in October of 1992. I'm Susan McGinnis. You've been listening to Conversations. Thanks, Bruce.
Thank you.
Pleasure to have you with us.
Good, thank you.
And I hope you join me again next week.